Well, I'd be grateful if you would turn back in the Bibles to the New Testament section, to page 113, about three-quarters of the way through the Bible, to John chapter 21. And as normally, the words, or the outline of the sermon will come up on the screen. Some of you, I know, like to take notes or may like to use the notebooks in front of you. This may help you to follow where we're going. We've come to the end of John's Gospel. You probably can hardly remember this. You may not even have been coming to All Saints then, but we began to preach on the first chapters of John in 2001, continued in 2002 and 3, took a break in 2004, and have finished the last four chapters this year. And the ending of the Gospel faces us with a key question. A key question, especially for us Britons in the 21st century. It's this: what place does Jesus have in your life? This is not a question about God. Britons today, I think, sometimes find it too easy to speak about God. We're into alternative spiritualities. We're quite happy to make up our own picture of God and say, that's the kind of God I can believe in. That, of course, is extraordinary arrogance, to think we can decide what God should be like. But in any case, this isn't a question about God. It's a question about Jesus. It's probably not an exaggeration to say that the New Testament is not primarily about God. Certainly the Gospels are not primarily about God, and most especially not the Gospel of John. The whole New Testament is about Jesus. More than any other book, the Gospel of John is about Jesus. If you were to go to the welcome desk after this service and order the complete set of tapes or CDs of all these sermons on John's Gospel, you would find that Jesus appears in the title of every single one of them. And these final verses ask, what place does Jesus have in your life? Is he central to my life? Is he peripheral? Or frankly, hardly getting a look in at all? Now these verses fall clearly into two sections. And the first is verses 20 to 23, Jesus and others. Jesus has just told Peter that when he is older, he'll be taken away by the authorities and killed. And then we're told, verse 20, Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. He was the one who reclined next to Jesus at the supper and had said, Lord, who is it that's going to betray you? When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about him? Jesus said to him, if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? Follow me. It had been a bitter pill for Peter to swallow, how his life would end. So when he saw John walking with them, he turned and said, what about him? It's the same with us. Amid the ups and downs of life, its difficulties and disappointments, we easily find ourselves asking, why me rather than him? Peter had just been told that he would be put to death. So he asked, verse 21, Lord, what about him? When our children have turned away from the Christian faith, and we see someone of our age walking into All Saints with their Christian child, we see the Hobbses with Rosie here between them, we think, why have my children fallen by the wayside and not theirs? When we aren't offered a job we've set our heart on, and someone else is, we ask, Why do I get turned down and he doesn't? When we're really struggling financially, and our brother or sister, who's much richer than we are, receives a legacy, we mutter to ourselves, why has God made life so tough for me and not for her? Or another way we compare ourselves with others is that we ask, why not me as well as him? And there may have been some of that here. Peter and John were part of Christ's inner circle of disciples. But perhaps Peter was bitterly conscious that John was, as verse 20 puts it, the disciple whom Jesus loved, who'd been specially close to Jesus and specially loved by Jesus. And perhaps that's why he asked in verse 21, what about him, Lord? It may have been plain jealousy. And we can feel that when we go to a conference or a service and the person that we're with is clearly met by God and deeply blessed by God, and God doesn't particularly speak to us at all. Or a single Christian can go to a wedding, particularly of a woman who is marrying later in life, and think, this is lovely for her. Why doesn't God do the same for me? Or a man can look at the people he was at school with or college with, some of them doing extremely well in their jobs, beginning to be well known, rich, and think, Lord, I've sought to do your will. Why couldn't I do as well in my career? And Jesus replies, that's my business. Verse 22, Jesus said to him, if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? It's not your business what I want to do for other people, says Jesus. It's mine. And then he adds, follow me. Literally, you follow me. In other words, don't keep looking over your shoulder and comparing yourself with other people, other Christians whom I'm blessing or other people at work. Keep your sights on me, on more and more closely following me. And then the writer adds, verse 23, so the rumor spread in the community that this disciple wouldn't die. Yet Jesus didn't say to him that he wouldn't die, but if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? Now this gospel seems clearly to have come from a circle of Christians who saw themselves as closely linked with the Apostle John. He was, as verse 20 puts it, the disciple whom Jesus loved, and they loved John. So they interpreted Jesus' saying about him to mean that Jesus would never die. Peter would die, Jesus had just said so, but John wouldn't. The writer of verse 23 says that's not true. They went to champion John against Peter. They were just, as Jesus said, to follow him. And we also are not to compare our hero with others. Many of us who've been Christians some time have Christian heroes. It may be a writer like John Stott, or a speaker like Jonathan Fletcher or Nicky Gumbel, or someone whose tapes we listen to and especially enjoy. But we're not to make out that our speaker or writer or Christian leader is better than anyone else. We are just to follow Christ faithfully ourselves. And so to the second section, Jesus and the Gospel of John. Verses 24 and 25 are a deliberate ending to the book. And they remind us of some important facts about this gospel. First, they say, it is true. Verse 23 has just been speaking about the Apostle John, and then verse 24 adds, this is the disciple who is testifying to these things and has written them, and we know that his testimony is true. Now, these last two verses, and perhaps the whole of chapter 21, were added by another disciple, probably after John's death. This gospel, they say, is the work of John. He was a witness of what he records. He wrote it down so that we can be quite sure this gospel is true. John himself had said much the same. If you turn back one page to page 111, John has written here about the unusual way Christ died. And then he adds, this is page 111, left-hand column, chapter 19, verse 35, John speaking about himself in the third person. He says, "He who saw this has testified so that you also may believe. His testimony is true, and he knows that he tells the truth." In other words, the Gospel of John is eyewitness writing about Jesus. Sometimes we worry about the Gospels. We read some pulp fiction like The Da Vinci Code, or we see some debunking TV program, and we find our faith is rocked. Is the New Testament really true? But these novelists writing in 21st century America, and even New Testament scholars researching today, simply cannot be compared with people who were actually there, who saw Jesus in action, who heard him and talked with him and lived with him. And this is what we have in John's gospel, the writing of the disciple who in many ways was closest to Jesus, who was right beside Jesus in most of the events that he records. This gospel, like the other gospels, is true. And second, say these verses, it is selective. If you turn back to page 113 and to the very last verse of the gospel, chapter 21, verse 25, the writer says, "But there are also many other things that Jesus did. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written." He is, of course, exaggerating to make a point. What he's saying is that there are many, many things which Jesus did which John has left out, because otherwise this book would be inordinately long. John himself has said much the same. If you look across to the opposite page, page 112, the end of chapter 20, chapter 20, verse 30, John says, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book." In other words, I've only included a fraction of Christ's signs or miracles, the ones that have special meaning for me. And that's why different incidents occur in different gospels. Many incidents occur in all four gospels. The feeding of the 5,000, for example, the Palm Sunday entry into Jerusalem, and of course the crucifixion and resurrection, which take up such a large part of all four Gospels. Other incidents occur in two or three Gospels only, and some only in one. To take some very famous examples, the three wise men come only in Matthew's Gospel. The parable of the prodigal son comes only in Luke. The miracle of the raising of Lazarus from death comes only in John. And that's because each gospel writer has been selective. Out of the vast amount of material available to him, he's picked those incidents, those teachings, which he feels are particularly significant. And what especially struck John was clearly different from what struck Matthew. But what is true of all the Gospels, what is especially said of John here, is that they concentrate entirely on Jesus. This is writing, chapter 21, verse 25, about what Jesus did. It's writing, chapter 20, verse 30, about the signs Jesus did as his disciples looked on. Which brings us back to our initial question. What place does Jesus have in my life, in your life? And in particular, as we look back over this whole book of the New Testament, what does John's Gospel tell us to do? And I suppose it's saying two things. First, make Jesus the focus of your mind. That's the force of the last two verses, verses 24 and 25. In John's Gospel, in the combined books of the New Testament and in the Old Testament too, we have many witnesses to Jesus, and these witnesses are true. So the message to us is, read to get at the truth about Jesus. I'm so glad that our book center is being used more and more, that an increasing number of us are borrowing and reading books from the church library. It's been one of the best developments here in the last 18 months. But I long that as a church family we would read more, watch television less, sit less in front of a computer, and read more about Jesus. I don't mean, of course, that we should only read Christian books. I've just started Boris Pasternak's Dr. Zhivago. I've just finished a book about the colonial powers' mismanagement of the Middle East in the 20th century. But I'm also reading the Bible every day with advice and help from my encourager. Today I start Hosea. And I'm also reading a book to think about how to think and talk about Jesus in urban Britain today. A man who's actually here in church this morning came to me recently and said, I'm retiring from work. I want to study the Christian faith more. And that's great. John is advising him how to do it. But why wait till retirement? We can read about Jesus on the train, or setting aside one night a week, or over the weekend. Beats the Financial Times any day of the week. Make Jesus the focus of your mind. And secondly, make Jesus the focus of your life. That's the force of the first section, verses 20 to 23. Don't, says Jesus, focus your life around other people, trying to model yourself on them, or being envious of them, or seeking to please them. In that sense, Jesus says, don't mind about others. Don't perpetually compare yourself with others. Instead, you follow me. And again, I found it enormously encouraging to see several in our church family clearly growing in your faith. I've seen this especially in part two of the Discovering Christianity course that I've been involved in. But it's obvious in the lives of quite a number of us. And I long for that for myself. I've been a Christian now for 37 years. But I don't want to stagnate. I don't want my Christian faith to stop deepening and growing. On the contrary, we want to follow Jesus, as I prayed at the beginning, more and more closely, so that in the practical, everyday reality, Jesus is increasingly the focus of our life. Let us pray.